Hello and welcome to this evening's conversation. I'm Ava Raspini, Assistant Curator here in the Department of Photography at MoMA. And before I begin tonight, I'd like to remind you to please silence your cell phones. Also, I'd like to call your attention to Stephanie here to my left, who's our sign language interpreter. And tonight we also have, in addition, closed captioning, which is here on my right. It is my great pleasure and honor to introduce Si-Chung Leong to you tonight. Si-Chung was born in 1970 in Mexico City and grew up in England. He then moved to the U.S. to study at the University of California at Berkeley and at Harvard University. In 1994, while working for 1 year at a Beijing architectural firm, he witnessed the first signs of so-called drastic urbanization in China. After completing his graduate degree at Harvard, Leong went back to China in 2000 only to realize how much has changed in less than one decade. Prompted by a growing sense of urgency, he engaged in an ambitious photographic project that began in earnest in 2002, which is known as History Images, of which there is a book published by Steidl, which I have here and which is available in our bookstores. This series focuses on the extraordinary wave of demolition, construction, and that has swept through China since the early 1990s. With a keen awareness of the archival traditions of such modernist luminaries as Charles Marville, Eugene Atje, and August Sander, Leong's history series captures in systematic fashion the rampant urbanization and constant flux of cities in which traditional Ming Dynasty courtyard houses are demolished to make way for generic high-rise megastructures. Some of the extraordinary photographs that he has made describe cities caught between the erasure of the past and the arrival of the future. As the Chinese capital and other centers rapidly cease to exist as historic cities, Leong is conscious of historical precedents elsewhere. Probably the most blatant example is Baron Haussmann's beautification plan of Paris in the 19th century under Napoleon III. This museum acquired 12 photographs by Leong in the past year for its collection, and we had four on view in an exhibition this past summer, which was titled Landscape. His work is in the collection of many other museums, including the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the Brooklyn Museum, the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago, among many others. He has also participated in many exhibitions, including at the High Museum in Atlanta, the Venice Architectural Biennial, the Taipei Biennial, and at the International Center of Photography here in New York. And now it's my great pleasure to welcome Si-Chung. Thank you.
Thank you, Eva. So, we're on. It's a profound privilege to speak here at this museum and to be included in its collections. And for this, I would like to thank, in particular, Roxana Marcocci, and also, of course, Eva, and, of course, Peter Galassi, and the many other curators here at MoMA for the very meaningful support of my work. And thank you also to Laura Bayliss for so skillfully organizing this talk. And thank you also for the audience for coming to hear me talk. So I will be talking about a series entitled History Images, which I've worked on from 2002 to 2005. I sometimes find it challenging to speak about my own work, partly because I believe that an explication of an image, say my explication, is really only one of many. And that in the end, an image really should be able to stand on its own without any kind of overbearing didactic luggage, particularly from the artist. And I also believe that the richness of meaning in an image really comes from the experiences that the viewer brings to the image. So that having been said, through this talk, I'll try my best to fill in some of the conceptual background to this series, and also to talk about some of my interests and intentions to give a sense of how this body of work developed. So I'd like to start with three images that give a very sweeping overview of history. The location happens to be in China, but I don't necessarily see my images as being just about China, as the forces and themes I'm interested in affect all cities. And it just, but it just happens that at this very point in time, this very point in history, it's affecting China in a particularly potent way. So as you look at these images, you might be able to imagine of a parallel set of cities, say medieval European cities, mid-19th century Paris, Industrial Revolution England, or wartime Europe and Japan, or even post-war American cities. And I think you'll be able to see that many of the forces that affect China now have shaped all of these cities in some way or another. So, which is to say that what I'm interested in is showing is how history is represented specifically through through the physical urban fabrics. So now I'll show the entire history of China in three images. It's horrifying, I know. So the first image, it represents the imperial period, which is really the majority of the history of China, until pretty much the beginning of the 20th century. And this is the period of history where China was ruled by dynasties and by emperors. The second image is of the socialist or the communist period, which in the long scheme of things is really the shortest amount of time, you know, starting in 1949 until the death of Mao. But it's probably one of the most abrupt and the most traumatic periods of history. And then the third image, which represents the current stage of the market economy, which is really only has occurred in the last decade, two decades and a half, but probably in terms of quantity represents the sort of the largest amount of change. So the reality of history is, of course, much more complex and nuanced than what I'm presenting here, and that's why I see the sequence as just as really just a diagram. But photographs often are really conceptual diagrams in very distilled form of what they're depicting. So this brings me to a question that I'm often asked, which is if I see my works as documentary photographs. On the most direct level, I think the answer is very obvious, which is yes, they are documentary photographs. But I think that the question is not a very easy one because the issues are very complex. The assumption in the question is that there can be an equivalence between the depiction, that is the photograph, and the real. And it's a complex issue also because a photograph, as with any other forms of visual representation, such as a painting, is made up of a series of very deliberate choices that multiply the ways in which reality can be interpreted, such as the subject that one chooses to photograph or depict, framing, lighting, focal length, composition, and all of these choices which are really at the basis of representation. So the final photograph is really a visual interpretation resulting from a series of very deliberate choices, arrangements, and editing that in the end convey a very particular attitude towards reality. So all this may not be you know, surprising and maybe kind of obvious, but the point that I'd like to make is that if the image is a malleable representation of reality, what I want to show is that history itself is also a very malleable a representation, that it can be manipulated to represent certain ideologies, certain beliefs, and certain forms of power in order to present these as the truth. And this is the focus of my series. So what occurs at the small scale of the image can also occur at the large scale of a city and even of history, with, of course, much vaster consequences. So this is what I've set out to show through my images, that cities and even history can be deliberately manufactured, composed, edited, and even erased to put forward a particular version of reality and the truth. And it's usually the version of reality sponsored by the regimes that have the power to make these changes on the scale of cities. So China, for me, is a particularly powerful example of how cities can be used to represent power, and how they can be used as a canvas on which the priorities of a regime and an economic system can be painted and represented. So the physical form of the city and its design and manipulation reveal a regime's or a society's attitude to how society should be organized and managed, how history should be understood and used, and how the future should be imagined and shaped. So China is a very also very powerful example because the country is governed by a very centralized and unchallenged and authoritarian form of government that has the ability to transform cities on a very large scale based on an ideological idea. And it's also experienced within a relatively short amount of time many of the major forms of power that the world has experienced. Imperial power, anarchy, communism, totalitarianism, and now capitalism. And also what's fascinating is that these changes and transformations of cities in history have happened so rapidly, literally within the course of one generation. So what's represented in these cities? So this image here is represents one of the imperial cities, one of the few remaining intact imperial cities in China. And what this represents is really the authority of the emperor. The emperor was seen as occupying the center of the country and also as being a reflection of the mandate of heaven, so heaven would be able to channel through the emperor and reflect the will of heaven onto reality. And that took the form of cities. So what happened is that the centralized power of the emperor would be able to wipe away cities, to destroy them, and then to build them completely anew. And so that's why they're so incredibly uniform. And so what happened is that the division of people would be in a hierarchy with the emperor at the top, and then all of the trades and all of the different ethnicities kind of going down as a pyramid below that. Now, with the communist period, these types of cities represented a very different form of power. This really represents the authority of an ideology, which is the communist ideology. And it, at the center of this was the place of the worker, so that cities were organized. If you can see on the right, there's these kind of workers' blocks. And this really made up the composition of cities, that cities were composed according to workers' units. And these, taken together, would be a structure within which the entire city was organized. And then the most current period of the market economy really represents the authority of the market system. And it has to do with the creation of markets and wealth, the circulation of commodities, and also in terms of a social division, it's a social division according to wealth. This is something we're very familiar with in contemporary cities. So all of these visions that as they have been played out in China are very total visions, which have required a very totalizing view of how these visions should be executed. You can see in the previous images that I've showed that they're extremely uniform, and that has required a certain type of authority of power to be able to have one idea and then to carry it out in this total way. So essential to this all-out execution and essential to the ability to build on a large scale is also the ability to erase, to start with a clean canvas on an urban scale in order to construct a particular version of history through selective elimination. So on the scale of the city, erasure becomes a political and ideological tool aimed at all previous periods of history. So to show how this is happening, this is a photograph of Nanjing, a city in the center of China. So this situation would otherwise be sort of like a geological accumulation of history, where you have history accumulating in strata. At the bottom kind of strata of buildings that you have here is represent the imperial buildings. In the middle, you have the buildings from the socialist period. And then on top, you have the buildings from the current period of the market economy. But while in many cities, you would have these accumulating at the same time and coexisting, in China, you have the current period of the market economy presiding over the destruction of the previous two. So in the present period, you see that all of the former periods of history are in the process of being erased. Here you have the Ming and Qing imperial period being destroyed in Beijing. This is the later imperial, the latter half of the 19th century, being destroyed in Shanghai. This is the colonial period where the European influence, European styles had a great influence in, particularly in Shanghai, and often were built by European occupiers in Shanghai, and these two also being destroyed. And then buildings from the nationalists, which is after the fall of the dynasty, and the socialist buildings also being destroyed. And this process of erasure often results in a blank slate from which a new history can be constructed. And often you see situations where there is absolutely no trace of what was there before. This is a photograph of Chongqing. And this hillside used to be covered in traditional buildings, but you see no traces of it anymore. So what's also remarkable about China is that this process of wiping clean and starting anew is consistent with other periods of Chinese history. It's almost like this process of erasure is a tradition in Chinese history. So during the imperial period, emperors... especially during changes of dynasties, emperors would conquer cities and then destroy them completely and then build them anew according to their own vision. And you can see this happened in Beijing, that Beijing is actually several cities on top of each other, but you don't see any traces of any of the previous cities. This also happened in the communist period, but it was a more of an ideological disdain of history. For instance... Chairman Mao, he wanted to destroy the Forbidden City, and he actually had this incredible disdain of anything old. Luckily, he was persuaded not to destroy the Forbidden City, but he did destroy a lot of the city fabric and even the old city walls that surrounded the city. But probably the most clear manifestation of this disdain of history was during the Cultural Revolution in the late 60s and early 70s. And it's encapsulated by one of the slogans during this period, which goes, smash the four olds. Old ideas, old culture, old customs, and old habits. And during this period, it in fact destroyed an entire culture. They smashed all sorts of old relics, temples, books. It was a period of complete insanity. And they would have actually gone further were it not for the lack of economic resources. And then so from this erasure emerges a completely new reality, which I've represented in the next few images. This image is interesting to me because the characters on top of the buildings, they simply say new city, which is kind of a very direct way of saying what it is. And so a new future emerges just waiting to be inhabited. Now, this new reality represents new priorities and relationships. And what these priorities are basically that the market economy and the state are now very intertwined. So this image is of a new city on the Yangtze River that was built recently, and you can see these relationships very clearly, where the semicircular building on the top right is the government center, the circular building in the lower left is the commercial center. This is the kind of the mall, I guess you could say. And so, to give a very kind of crass interpretation of the image, here you have the brain of the government, and then representing the kind of ideology of communism, and then the stomach of capitalism sort of processing people. And so after all of this erasure, the question is, what place does history have in this new order? This image is of Hangzhou, which is one of the oldest and most significant cities. It was a city visited by Marco Polo in the 13th century, and in his diaries, apparently, he said that this was the most splendid city in the world. And actually, Hangzhou doesn't kind of let you forget that. But the city was actually destroyed during the 19th century by the Taiping Rebellion. And so you actually don't see any of that history anymore. It's a semi-generic experience experiencing the city. But you do see these pockets of traditional history, such as this image. But the thing is that this is not the actual historical fabric. What it is, it's a remade, reconstructed historical area. And so what it really points out, it's reconstructed as a shopping mall, as a tourist attraction. But it really indicates the kind of general attitude towards history, which is that history needs to be able to be used for specific purposes for the present, which in this case is tourism and commerce. So the past really, and it ceases existing as a living history, as a history that has a correspondence between its form and its actual historical use. So in the end, the manipulation of urban fabrics portrays an idealized view of history through the lens of a particular ideology, a particular form of power, a particular government. And it's similar in a way to the way that the tradition of history painting portrayed particular views of history through the lens of particular regimes, ideologies, and moralities. It sort of goes back to the point I was making that that in the way that images can be composed to portray specific or particular forms of reality, cities and history are also liable to be manipulated in the same way. So history is seen as something to be rewritten, and is something that can occur in books, images, and even cities. And each of these are mediums that can be equally manipulated. So one of the greatest casualties of this view of history is the layered accumulation of history. That is, cities where you can see all of the different histories accumulating simultaneously, and where all this historical development is compressed into one moment of time, and where the richness of a city comes from this kind of multiple experience and from the dialogue between different histories. And in this image, you can see this is Chongqing, where you can see the different histories of the imperial period, of the socialist buildings, and the current period all coexisting together. But it's a very short-lived coexistence because much of this, especially the old fabric, according to the City Planning Bureau, was slated to be demolished. And also one of the other casualties are spaces that fall outside of the purview of the dominant system. And where, as I mentioned before, the historical form coincides with historical uses, such as in this traditional village in Shanxi province, in the center of China. But these spaces are becoming increasingly rare. And you can see actually the difference between the actual historical form of the village in the center, and then there's a wall on the top left. And that is one of the traditional buildings that's being reconstructed for the tourist industry. So this the time that I was photographing in China. China really found itself in a period in between histories, so these photographs have tried to reveal these layers of past histories making way for the new. And I've also photographed in most of the major cities throughout China because I think this phenomenon is really it's a very widespread phenomenon that doesn't have any specificity to the exact cities. The other casualty is really the specific forms of the particular two particular places, and these are being replaced by something that's more general. So the previous image was in Shanghai. This is in Xiamen, which is in the south. Shanghai again. And I've arranged these images in a way to suggest that to suggest this gradual replacement of the old. And it's not a situation where the histories are coexisting, but really it's one sort of vanishing at, or one existing emerging at the expense of another. And another thing that's interesting about the situation in China with this kind of erasure of the old is that it's really a very deliberate erasure, because erasure of urban fabrics can occur in so many different ways, such as natural disasters or warfare or battles between different regimes. But in China, it's really a deliberate kind of destruction, but that has the effects and the power of natural disasters or of warfare, in terms of displacements of people, in terms of the kind of trauma that happens to cities. And through these images, again, I could see the sort of particular forms that are very specific to places, such as in the north in Beijing, the previous image in Shanghai. And then so the gradual disappearance of the old to be replaced by the new. And so the goal of this process of rewriting of history is to create this fully formed, structured, and ordered vision of the current worldview. So this was a photograph of a new development in Beijing, which didn't even have a name yet. So the image is titled New Street. So the ultimate effect is the creation of a singular version of history, representing a singular authority, a singular power, and a singular ideology. This was the desire of the emperors and also the communists, and to a much more carefully worded extent, the current regime. So the fact that Premier Hu Jintao is calling for what he calls a harmonious society could sound very sincere on one level, but very ominous on another, particularly when you see what is happening to all of the messy and discordant aspects of cities and society that don't fit within the current system. So I'd like to mention some quotes that seem very applicable here and say better than I can say about these ideas, and whose meaning has definitely lived longer than the time in which they were said. The first was I was alerted to by Nigel Warburton, who lectures in philosophy, and it's a quote from George Orwell from 1984, and it's one of the party slogans. It goes like this: "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." So Mao Zedong said it in his own way, probably in kind of a more blunt way. So he said, "Let the past serve the present." But I think the one that encapsulates it more and actually represents the reality of the situation is a slogan from the Cultural Revolution. And that slogan says, "Smash the old world, build a new world." So the last image is of Tiananmen Square. And it's a space that's created as a blank slate from the erasure of a large portion of the imperial city. It's an incredibly symbolic space, in the sense that it's really the spatial expression of state power. It was one of the first moves that Mao did as far as claiming Beijing, and it really symbolizes the center of ideology. The center of the capital, at the center of the Middle Kingdom, and this—the power of the space really derives from from its emptiness, but also from the history of events that have occurred in this space, all of the movements, all of the protests, and so on, that are no longer visible. And so for me, what it ultimately suggests is that one of the greatest and most valued powers of the state is the authority to erase. So thank you.
So now we're going to have a moderated discussion, as they call it, where we'll take a seat here and I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll open up to the audience for whatever questions you may have. So if you'd like to take a seat. That was really wonderful. Thank you. I have to say I was really struck by the scale, how awesome it was to see those cities on the scale. And maybe I'll get back to that in a second. But first I wanted to ask you, I was struck by something you said in the beginning of your talk about history being constructed and reality being constructed, and how photography has very much had a role in that construction of history and of reality. And I wanted to ask you how you looked at your photographs as either participating in that construction or manufacturing of reality, or working against it, or perhaps doing both at the same time?
Right. I think that it's a very challenging question, because there's a certain inevitability about producing an image and also about participating in the same kinds of ways that images are constructed, mm-hmm. like you said. So I think that that's something that you have to kind of to deal with in the production of an image. And as far as your question about how it participates in that history, I think that there's some things that are kind of beyond the purview of the photographer, mm-hmm. also, because that, you know, I'm not quite sure how in the end it will participate in history, because that's really up to the viewers and how it's received in history.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm not so sure. I think that's something that time will tell.
Well, certainly you seem very aware, or during your talk, I was very aware of this continuum of history, of this kind of erasure and replacement and rewriting. And one of the things that I mentioned in my introduction, and as I'm kind of alluding to here in terms of the participation of photography in this rewriting of history, is the participation that photographers have had in recording and commenting on various erasures, rewriting of certain histories in other cities. And I'm thinking in particular of Charles Marville and Eugene Atje, who in the late 19th century and early 20th century documented Paris, or even Robert Adams in the 1960s documenting the expansion of suburban sprawl in the West, in the United States. And I'm curious to hear from you whether any of these photographers have had an influence on your work, and how much you've been looking at them or thinking about them in this history series.
I think it's they've been incredibly influential, all the photographers that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And particularly the earlier photographers from the mid-19th century, mm-hmm. Who kind of started the whole thing, I guess. Because I've paid a lot of attention to the photographers such as Marville and Agé. Mm-hmm. And even photographers such as Felice Beato and John Thompson, who were among the first to photograph in places that weren't familiar to Western eyes. Mm-hmm. And I think that any photographer who starts up doing this kind of thing is participating within this kind of tradition, and a tradition that involves things like the construction of an image, the way that an image adds to a certain type of knowledge, which is actually something that was very influential to me about the way that Marville and Agé approached photography, because they approached it really as a form of knowledge, as accumulating knowledge through visual means. Mm-hmm. So that was very influential. Mm-hmm. And of course, Robert Adams looking at the West. These are all things that exist in the consciousness of making images. Mm-hmm. So certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you mentioned Beato, who did photograph extensively in China, and brought photographs back as a kind of travel log or experience of his travels for people to see these new places, which in a way, ironically, some of your pictures function in the same way for those people who haven't been to China in the West. And I wonder, when you approach these cities, one of the things that struck me as I was looking at these images again on the screen is that for quite a few of them, there is this kind of maybe what I'll call the God view, which is like in film, when you open up, there's a narrative of a city and you begin from high up and you come down and it sets the scene. This is the city we're in. And you, and in many of your pictures, we are sort of removed. We're high up and we have a kind of sense of this expanse, which is, you know, absolutely incredible and extraordinary in so many of those photographs. And I wondered very much how you approach photographing a city and how you make choices and how you discover a city and how you move from looking down onto it to those where it seems like you're really walking in, you know, amongst the rubble.
I think approaching any city, it involves the whole spectrum of approaching it from seeing the city as a kind of pattern, which is the photographing it from above, from a view where you can actually see the city in, you know, I mean, not in its totality, but as much as a totality as possible. Mm-hmm. And then also to give the ground view, to see what's actually going on from a personal perspective. I mean, I don't see personal in terms of the photographer's own personal perspective, but the inhabitant in the city. So I think that's very important. But I think for the... it's interesting how you the description of the kind of God's eye view images, and it reminds me of a question that I was asked a while ago, which is similar to the first question that you asked about participating in creating an image, which in itself is kind of a manipulation of reality, mm-hmm. and participating in that whole history. And so the question that I was asked is if this kind of bird's eye view that I'm taking is participating in the same kind of manipulation that city planners or governments take a look at, mm-hmm. At cities, and I think that that to a certain extent is true, because in order to see the patterns of a city, you do have to have this very elevated view. But it's not to say that this view is owned by anyone. It's mm-hmm. not owned by the powers and the structures that be. It's something that you can actually take for yourself, so that it's not any one particular point of view. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. that makes sense.
No, absolutely. One of the things I alluded to a little bit earlier when I said it was kind of extraordinary to see these photographs up on the screen is because of the scale. And for those of you in the audience that haven't had the pleasure of seeing these photographs in person, they are obviously not as big as the screen. But they are quite large in scale and very rich in detail. Might you talk just a little bit about those choices you're making in terms of the scale, and I'm thinking also in terms of the human scale, how people sort of become these very tiny players in this large kind of narrative that is unfolding in the photographs?
It is a very sort of important choice as to the scale of the photograph. And I think particularly for these photographs that I'm taking of very wide urban scenes, because I think that at a certain point, the scale of the photograph, it has to be a certain size where it kind of overwhelms your visual field, yeah. And particularly when there's so much detail. And the approach that I'm taking towards cities is I want to show structures at a very large scale. Mm-hmm. So, and I think the experience of seeing a photograph should be somewhat like that. But also, I'm often asked, how come there's no people in my photographs? And the thing is that the way that I'm photographing is that there actually are people, but they're just shown in proportion to these large urban urban structures. Mm-hmm. So I think the size of the photograph has to communicate that. So you can see that the entire structure, but then zoom down to see the people walking on the sidewalk.
Mm-hmm. I thought you had a quite wonderful description of that photograph with the brains and the stomach, and the sort of stomach churning out all these kind of ant-like people. That was really quite wonderful. Another thing that struck me as you were talking is that you acknowledge this kind of erasure through the kind of displacement or destruction of architecture is not has been common in many other cities, many other countries, and China just in particular at this moment interested you. And I wanted to ask you whether there were other countries, other cities that were of interest to you. You know, one of the things that pops into my mind is Dubai. You read all these articles about the incredible amount of building that's going on there. So I was wondering if photographically there are other areas that you have been interested in perhaps pursuing for projects.
Well, my current series, actually my current two series that I'm working on is precisely about that. It's about looking at cities and environments on a global scale, so really photographing all over the world, and trying to form connections between these different environments and links linked connections between all of these different places. So I've been traveling to places that kind of represent as much of a variety over the world as possible, and drawing these connections. Mm-hmm. So the first series has to do with a kind of overt linking between these environments in the display of the photographs, and then the second series is a series about cityscapes throughout the world, mm-hmm. and photographed in the same kind of manner.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you have any plans on showing these new series anytime soon?
Well, yes, I'm working towards a show in early 2008 at Yossi Milo Gallery.
Wonderful.
So which will be the first showing of these images.
Great. Well, I don't want to monopolize all of the time. I have plenty more questions, but I thought perhaps I would open up to the audience to see if there were any questions from any of you. Yes.
Essentially, do you see any a relationship between the your images of cities and the series that Thomas Struth did of depopulated cities, some in Europe, some in South America? Mm-hmm. And has his work in any way influenced yours?
Well, his work has been very important to my own development as a photographer, and it's in the way similar to what I said about that once one participates in constructing images, it's kind of enter into a tradition or a dialogue. And so so I've looked at his images very closely, and they have sort of formed part of that consciousness of looking at places. And I think that once one forms that consciousness, then it's a matter of how to contribute to it, and what I saw is to focus on something very specific, the way that history is manipulated in cities, but the language certainly shares a lot of resonances with this tradition of large format photographs of cities. So I hope that answered your question.
In European and American cities like Paris and New York, the kind of new housing you're describing that was built in the late 19th century and early 20th century was generally built on the margins of the old cities, like Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue, West End Avenue, and so forth, or the 16th and 17th arrondissements in Paris. And the older neighborhoods were not destroyed. They were just abandoned to poor people. Why is the pattern so different in China? Why is there this active destruction of older neighborhoods?
What's very unfortunate about the situation in China, particularly the centers of the cities, is that through since 1949, and particularly through the Cultural Revolution, there was this incredible disdain of anything old. And actually, the word "old" in the Chinese language can mean both just old as we know it, but it can also be
a pejorative term, you know, to say that it's something that's tired and that needs to be retired. So what has happened is that many of these traditional neighborhoods have decayed to the point that the official language that's used to describe these places is that they're called slums, and they're even called dangerous and dilapidated. And this kind of terminology, of course, you know, produces a certain attitude towards these places, which eases their erasure and their destruction. So what you see in most of the in Chinese cities in the center is that most of these places are being destroyed and then replaced by the new kinds of buildings.
Is there any sign of revival of some of these older neighborhoods, say the way that the Marais in Paris, which was the most aristocratic neighborhood in the 18th century and then became a terrible slum in the early and mid-20th century and is now once again one of the chicest neighborhoods in Paris? Mm-hmm. Is there any sign of that happening in the older parts of Chinese cities?
It is happening in certain areas, and it happens in two ways. One is that areas are completely destroyed and then rebuilt to look like what it was before. So this actually still falls within the guidelines of preservation in China. But mostly these are built for commercial purposes. So there's a very famous shopping street in Shanghai that was exactly that, where this huge area of traditional houses was completely destroyed. And then one street was rebuilt, and that's the most famous area, so it seems like, you know, a lot of it is being rebuilt. And then the second way is very similar to what happens in many other cities, which is it's just a matter of wealth, and just it's a matter of wealthy families moving into a certain area and then renovating houses. And that happens in certain areas, say in Beijing or even Shanghai, but it's very small.
Yes, down here. Thanks.
I noticed that, of course, all the skies in your photographs are a uniform gray. Was that meant to be neutral, just so that you could compare each picture sort of with the same substrate, or was that meant to be kind of a dirge for the death of these cities, or was it just the artifact of the smog or the particular day that you were taking them?
Actually, you've answered both. It was a deliberate choice to look for these kinds of conditions. First of all, because this particular kind of lighting, I actually do prefer in terms of the way that it shows all of the visual information, because there's no, without deep shadows, you can actually, there's a lot more equivalence between what's dark and what's light. And so there's a more kind of even way of looking at the entire picture. Another reason is that the skies actually are like that for, especially most of the winter, when there's a lot of coal being burned, which is a lot of the period when I was photographing during the winter. So it does give this kind of very even look. And I guess the third reason is for its kind of its emotional impact, and it does give a certain, you know, feeling to the image.
I noticed that many of the photographs have these huge apartment blocks that sort of look like East Berlin. Is it because of prices, or is it because they have so many people they have to build them that way?
It is because of economics, primarily. Because building of a certain size has a certain equation, you know, towards the returns that they get for the money that they put in. But also there are some building regulations where, you know, you have to have a certain proportion of or a certain thickness of a building, so that drives it also. But I think primarily it's economics that drives all these decisions.
Is that representative of building throughout China, these kind of apartment blocks?
It is, actually. I think it'll vary slightly between regions. For instance, in the south of China, you might get some thinner buildings. I'm not sure what the reasons are for the thinner buildings, but generally, I mean, in terms of the scale of the buildings, it is quite representative.
I'm just curious to hear your thoughts on the merits or maybe the lack of the aesthetic quality of buildings, let's say, before the communist era. Comes across as ambiguous in your work.
You said before the communist era.
Yeah, imperial.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what is important about the buildings, what I've been calling traditional buildings, but pre-communist buildings, is that the way that they're constructed, the way that they're arranged and configured, and even the kind of iconography, they all are very specific to their places and specific to their uses and also specific to the times in which they were built. And there's an incredible variety of buildings throughout the entire country, because the entire country is not, it's not homogeneous as far as spaces and as far as styles. And that's what's being lost by this kind of wave of replacement of new buildings. So I think its importance really is as artifacts that portray very specific things about very specific places in China.
I'd actually like to jump in with a question. There seems to be a lot of kind of comments and reactions to these cities that perhaps are not so familiar. But I wonder if you've shown the work in China and what the reaction has been from perhaps those people who live in cities where this construction is happening all around them.
I have. It's actually hard to tell, strangely enough, because I've given a talk maybe once or twice in China about my work. And from what I felt is that the response was generally very positive. As far as demonstrating something that people kind of agreed with and empathized with. But strangely enough, sometimes it's the most difficult for the artist to know,
mm-hmm.
Or the person who's creating the work, because sometimes you don't know what the response is. I've also exhibited the work once there, and it was the same thing where I did get some comments saying that this, you've really shown what is going on, the whole tragedy of the changes in China.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the response is generally good, but it's difficult to know, kind of, in a more general sense, what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, one of the really interesting responses I got was when I talked about this work in Venice, and one of the older professors at the university that I talked at, he said, "Your images are lies," because he said that his experience with China is one of bustling crowds and neon lights and so on. And, I mean, I had no choice but to agree with him, because uh-huh. that's the nature of images, is they only show a certain focus.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to get that reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm curious, how much could you speak to how much influence of your training in architecture influenced you as an artist?
I think that's. I think I realized, because I worked in architecture for a bit, that the interests that I had as far as looking at cities or thinking about cities and environments wasn't necessarily put to best use through architecture. My interest really was in cities, and as an architect, one's involvement in thinking about cities and thinking about what makes or the reasons why cities are the way they are. You have relatively little involvement as an architect, and I think that as a photographer, the involvement is very different, because you have this way of seeing larger phenomena in a very different way. And also there's a certain amount of freedom from being involved in the nitty-gritty of constructing cities that I think gives a lot more sort of intellectual and conceptual freedom.
your photographs portray China as, in many ways, a monolith of what I would say not very attractive architecture, yet when you visit, it's both people and, I would say, some of the best architecture going on in the world, and yet was your objective to just show the sort of homogenization of China without showing the alternative?
Well, I think, as I sort of explained in the beginning of the lecture, that the presentation of any sort of body of work involves editing, involves a selection of a certain aspect. And I chose to concentrate on the aspects of the development of China that that at least have the largest quantity, and that represents the development of China as far as just the amount of stuff that's being built. And I agree with you actually that there are many buildings that are of a lot of merit in the country, but as far as the proportion, it's extremely small. And so, which in the scale of things aren't necessarily relevant to the entirety of what's happening.
You used the word tragedy of China in one of your answers. You used the phrase the tragedy of China just a few minutes ago, and. Would you comment on that a little bit?
It's I think that many of the aspects, especially from what I'm depicting about this erasure of this entire history in built form is an extreme tragedy, and it's really kind of the culmination of a whole historical development that that started a long time ago. I've talking to some to people in China who have actually experienced all of these developments. For instance, the Cultural Revolution, which is the most traumatic and also most tragic sort of period that China has gone through. They say that's the moment at which everything really changed. That even the basic relationships between people fundamentally changed because the whole structure of trust was destroyed. And I think that in the kernel really represents what has gone on the larger scale as far as this kind of disdain for a physical heritage. And as I'm saying this, I've often been asked if I'm nostalgic or if I'm about what's about the old. It's actually not the case because cities have to evolve, and they have to always be in the present. But I think that the most desirable situation is when all of these histories can coexist and can evolve at the same time, and not be erased. And I think that's what the tragedy is.
Were there any more questions? I thought I saw one down here somewhere. Yes.
It deals again with the question, the issue of the same uniform sky in your images. Is that created digitally, and to what extent is your work a reconstruction, or created not through the eye of the camera, but through the use of the computer?
The images are digitally printed, but as far as the manipulations, they're very similar to traditional manipulations that one would do in the darkroom. So as far as controlling color balance and the density as far as lightness and darkness. So it isn't, I wouldn't say that, most people think of digital manipulation as changing a photograph to the extent that it has no relationship to what was actually there. But a traditional photograph there is a certain degree of difference between what is depicted and how it's depicted. So what I'm doing with the skies, for instance, is that I do dodge them in a way that I would if I was traditionally printing, to make them lighter, but it's really, you know, an aesthetic effect. But the whiteness is really something that is what I see as reflecting my perception of the real situation. So, you know, I did photograph mostly under white skies.
Has there been any attempts any time when you've been photographing in China to stop you, either by developers or by officials or by just people saying, we don't want this recorded, we don't want this documented, or whatever?
I have had a whole range, although I was only stopped once. And that was a really interesting situation because I was photographing in an area that was being demolished. And as I was photographing, this glass kind of ran over and just, you know, tried to stop me. But I managed to get shoot off one image. And the reason why I was stopped actually is because the developer who had was in charge of the site had been arrested because of corruption and was in jail. And the government official who was helping this person had not yet been. It was a scandal between the relationship between the developer and the government official. So that was the reason why they didn't want any photographs. But otherwise, when I've been in areas, and for instance, if residents will come up and start talking to me or to one of my assistants to translate, they think I'm taking a survey or part of the whole sort of development scheme, they'd be kind of suspicious. But then once they explain to them that I'm photographing the changes, then they start talking about, they're very kind of welcoming and say this is something that should be done. So it does run the whole range.
I'd like to thank you very much for your generosity with sharing your work with us this evening and your thoughts on your work. It was really quite wonderful. And I want to thank all of you for spending this evening with us, and thanks for coming.